This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Sudanese journalists and trade unions called for more anti-government protests today.
Also, we'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Police in eastern DRC fired live ammunition and tear gas today to break up protesters angry about a decision to exclude them from Sunday's presidential election. Dozens of protesters attacked Ebola treatment centers in Beni and burned tires after the Electoral Commission announced yesterday it was delaying voting until March in the cities of Beni, Butembo, and surrounding areas because of a deadly Ebola outbreak. About two dozen patients fled an Ebola isolation center. The most had not tested positive for the disease, and a few quickly returned. Voting also was delayed in the western city of Yumbi because of ethnic violence. The areas where voting will be postponed are centers of opposition to outgoing President Joseph Kabila, who replaced his assassinated father in 2001. The election to replace Kabila was originally set to take place in 2016, but has been repeatedly delayed for more than 2 years. The opposition has called for a workers' strike throughout Congo tomorrow to protest the delays, which could affect more than 1 million voters.
Some Rwandan Christians claim a law that prevents churches from making noise while worshiping is ruining their prayer rhythm and festive season when they're traditionally thankful. Rwanda's government has ordered churches to reduce their volume or by soundproofing to keep their sounds indoors. Failure to comply could mean getting shut down. Eugene Uimana has details from Kigali.
The sounds of drums, guitars, pianos, and whistles, accompanied by dances and jumping, are what the government says churches need to control for the sake of the common good. But some Christians believe they are told in the Bible that they should dance to celebrate and offer thanks and praise. Jean Vutingoma thinks Christmas should be special. They should let us free, at least in these days. Some have passed away, but we are still alive. We have so much thanksgiving to dance the way we want, beating drums, as long as we are not betraying the country.
I can just carry court.
For other Rwandans who live near churches are backing the noisy law. Shabana Kaitale says some people don't share the same belief or may be in their other business and get disturbed by the sounds of worship. It's their right to celebrate Christmas, but their gatherings have to conform to the general security. They can sing or pray silently without disturbing others. Johnson Businge, Attorney General and Minister of Justice, says the government has made itself clear that all activities have to respect others. People have different plans in the city. Some go out while others are sleeping. Some pray while others are in sports. So we are trying to define the indices of noise that make it pollution. But those who pray can easily know that they are disturbing people according to what they are doing. They have to abide by that regulation. A crackdown on poor infrastructure has closed some 8,000 churches this year, and the sound issue could raise the number. Critics say the government is infringing on freedom to worship, but it says it's just making sure churches operate safely and properly. Parliament passed another law in July requiring pastors to have a theological degree from an accredited school. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Madagascar's Electoral Commission says provisional results show that André Rajoelina has won the country's tightly contested runoff election for president. Rajoelina previously led the country after taking power in a 2009 coup. He won nearly 57% of the vote to defeat Marc Ravalomanan, who was ousted in the coup. The two candidates were both banned from running in the 2013 election as part of an agreement to end recurring crises that have rocked Madagascar since independence from France in 1960. The High Constitutional Court has 9 days to decide whether to confirm the results. Turnout was put at 48%, lower than the 54% in the first round ballot that eliminated other contenders. Madagascar is well known for its vanilla and precious redwood, yet it is one of the world's poorest nations, according to World Bank data, with 76% of its people living in extreme poverty.
The Nigerian government is calling on states to enact laws to ban open defecation. The Minister of Water Resources has said it is regrettable that Nigeria has the second largest population after India defecating in the open. About 66 million Nigerians don't have access to toilets. The ministry has developed a roadmap and action plan to reposition the water and sanitation sectors. Key to the plan is ending open defecation by 2025 as part of the Sustainable Development Goals. Abukami Joseph is an environmentalist in Port Harcourt. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the problems caused by open defecation and the challenges to ending the practice in thousands of rural communities. He says states and local governments in the country should partner with international agencies and private organizations to provide public toilets for the rural communities.
The health hazards associated with open defecations are numerous, but let me just highlight these ones: cholera, typhoid, and diarrhea. How do these happen? Typhoid is mostly gotten from drinking polluted waters. When we defecate openly, these feces simmer into underground waters. In riverine communities where open defecation is practiced, people mostly defecate into the rivers, into these water bodies. And these water bodies move, and eventually people drink water from sources they assume is clean sources. Meanwhile, these sources of water have migrated from sources where they have defecated into them, and this causes typhoid. Diarrhea, as we know, is continuous stooling. Diarrhea also is an impact of open defecation, because when you are pressed, you will be forced to defecate anywhere. But when you defecate anywhere, these parasites will still fester on these feces and will ingest it and will still lead to this diarrhea. So these are the issues.
The federal government has urged states to make bylaws to ban open defecation. Do you think it will end it?
I think it will go a long way. Even if in this part of the country, it is one thing to enact laws and it's one thing to implement. But before you implement anything, you must enact. So that is why the first step is to enact these laws to ban open defecation. Then leave it to the statutory authorities to enact these laws.
What should the states and local governments do to end the practice in the rural communities?
Thank you very much, because that is where the problem is. It is mostly in the rural communities, because in the metropolis, there are a lot of public toilets. You can go to any fast food. But in the rural communities, they don't have this luxury. Oftentimes, they are challenged with public toilet system. And the public toilet system in some communities, they have this challenge of culture, where a man cannot share a toilet with a woman. Some have this culture of hierarchy. A junior cannot share a toilet with a senior. And when they do not have enough toilets, there's already a problem, because where there's a problem with disparity of gender, when a man is pressed and a woman is in the toilet, he will need to go and use an open place to defecate. Where there's a problem with hierarchy, if an elderly is pressed and a younger one is pressed, the elderly man will have the preference to use the toilet and the younger one will have to go to the open places to go and defecate. So these are the challenges. So that is where local government and state governments come in. Local government is the first connection to the general public before you get the state government. local governments can build public sanitary systems for these communities. It is appalling to note that even UNICEF has stated that in 774 local governments in Nigeria, only 3 local governments have put in structures to palliate open defecation. It is beyond 1%. It is even beyond 0.05% of 774 local governments. So it is not rocket science. It is what local governments can do. They can go to 2, 3, 4 communities every year. By the time they do this in 5 years, almost all the communities in each local government will have access to a public toilet. Luckily, there are some states like Rivers State, Ondo State, Kaduna State have partnered with this NGO by releasing counterpart funding that will aid these NGOs to set up this system, but it is not enough. The local governments are the first tier that connects with the common man. They are the ones that have the sole responsibility to provide these amenities.
That was environmentalist Abukami Joseph in Port Harcourt speaking with journalist Mike Mbonye. Sudanese journalists and trade unions called for more anti-government protests today, and the head of the country's parliament agreed to question the interior minister about the use of force against peaceful demonstrators. The protesters are calling for President Omar al-Bashir to resign. Journalists and union members calling for new demonstrations both inside the country and outside want to draw attention to the government's use of violence against people protesting rising food and fuel prices. The government says 8 protesters have been killed in 2 weeks of demonstrations, while some opposition groups say more than 12 people have died. In a speech to graduating military cadets today, President Bashir blamed Western nations for causing the country's economic crisis. The U.S. lifted economic sanctions on Sudan in October, but the Sudanese pound has continued to lose much of its value against the dollar, prompting shortages of bread, fuel, and currency.
Our colleague Ayen Dengbior yesterday spoke with one of the protesters in Khartoum, Rudwan Dawid. He says they have no plans to back down on their demands.
Sudan is just in a point where it is like going through a total collapse of a state. So everything is just messed up, and the government has no idea about what is going on.
This isn't the first time that protesters in Sudan have taken to the streets. What's different about this time?
This one, the December uprising, it is the largest, and more cities and states are participating now. Sudanese people of all different backgrounds.
Why do you think that is?
From the north, south. Because what is going on is affecting everybody. Even the, you know, school students, they cannot go to school because they don't have money to buy food. People are living in just one meal a day. And, you know, the prices are skyrocketing. And we have shortage of gas and oil. And the banks, you know, they have no money. You can't even, you know, withdraw your own money from the bank. So it is just miserable. And the poverty level is just hitting every family. So it is all just messed up.
And how has the Sudanese government responded to the protesting?
They are responding, unfortunately, brutally. Just yesterday, we had one of the big protests. We were planning to deliver, Sudanese. We were trying to go to the presidential palace to ask the president to step down. We were faced by bullets. I have heard 2 people have lost their lives, but I'm not quite sure about it yet, but I have seen many people who were wounded, and many young peaceful protesters were arrested, beaten, and it was just crazy. Khartoum was like a battlefield. It wasn't like it doesn't look like a city anymore now.
There's reports that the government used live ammunition. Have you seen any evidence of that?
Yes, I did. Yes, and I known people in a personal way. Yesterday, I talked to one of the young activists who had been hit in his leg. Luckily, he's still alive right now at the hospital. But he was hit by a real bullet. And this is just one symbol.
But President al-Bashir says he will introduce real reforms, and he says that the protesters are just introducing discord to the country. What's your reaction to that?
The president has no credibility. Nobody has zero respect for him because he has been lying over and over again. Even his own people, the village where he was born, they are turning against him right now because he knows he's been like a burden right now.
That was Rudwin Dawit, a political activist, speaking to Ian Dieng Bior from Khartoum. Whether talking about ending poverty and hunger, taking action on climate change, or building peace, justice, and strong institutions, each of the UN's 17 Sustainable Development Goals interlocks with all the others. However, for Lori Adelman of Women Deliver, a global advocacy organization that champions girls and women, it is goal number 5, gender equality, that holds the key to the others' success. Adelman began her conversation with VOA's Adam Phillips by explaining that family planning, including for young people, is crucial to achieving that goal.
The bedrock of gender equality is really women's ability to decide on their own bodies and their own fertility. We know that it's so important to reaching global goals that we all share for driving development, and family planning is a key piece of that.
What are some of the hard numbers that bear this out?
We know that over 200 million women in developing countries have an unmet need for family planning. There are then 74 million unplanned pregnancies worldwide that occur as a direct result of this unmet need. And we know that it's also not cost effective to leave that unmet need on the table. If we were to invest in family planning, spending just $1 for contraceptive services reduces the cost of pregnancy-related care by nearly $1.50. And so we really are looking at family planning as not only the right thing to do, the smart thing to do, but also just a great investment from the perspective of growing a country and developing a nation.
But family planning isn't just about national development.
Exactly. That's why our goal also includes information and education, because no woman is only her reproductive health system. She has a whole life and future that she deserves to be able to plan for herself. And this includes people who may be living in poverty, and this includes marginalized people who often face increased barriers to accessing these kinds of options. So everyone should have the same opportunity to plan their lives and their futures in the way that they choose, the smart thing to do, and it's the right thing to do.
I know Women Deliver operates worldwide, but isn't the need for proper family planning for women especially acute in sub-Saharan Africa?
That's very much the case across sub-Saharan Africa, and this has huge implications, for example, in enrollment rates in schools in sub-Saharan Africa, where just 92 girls per 100 boys are enrolled in primary school. Whereas we know that if we could keep girls in school beyond grade 7, they're more likely to marry later, they're more likely to voluntarily choose to have fewer children. And so this is all tied to many different factors, how we value girls, but also in particular, their access to family planning and contraception. And this is really where the role of advocacy comes into play. It really comes down to needing all different kinds of partners to come together. Political leaders, the scientists and the researchers, the policymakers, young people. Young people are leading the way in many cases on this issue.
Are these young advocates mostly health professionals or even healthcare trainees, per se?
So not all of them are healthcare professionals. Some of them are working directly with the government or themselves running for office with this issue as part of their agenda. Some people are using more creative or non-traditional approaches to raise awareness about the importance of family planning, engaging in, for example, a flash mob, in a busy local square or mall, so that people can kind of stop and have a better understanding of their rights and how family planning could fit into their life. So this is not a case of a top-down down message, you know, some leaders telling young people what they need. People are actually demanding access to their health and rights via voluntary and high-quality family planning services that really do meet them where they are and meet their needs. And so with Women Deliver, we support an awesome network of young leaders, and they're taking charge in their community to make sure that not only themselves, but their peers, their colleagues, the members of the community that they care about have access to these services that they know will have such a big impact on their lives.
That was Lori Ottleman, the Youth Engagement Director for Women Deliver, a global organization dedicated to the health, rights, and well-being of women and girls. She spoke with Adam Phillips in New York.
In 2018, sitting leaders relinquished power in South Africa and Ethiopia. Zimbabwe elected a new leader after 37 years of rule by former President Robert Mugabe. Peaceful power transitions were also seen in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Mali. But while many find those trends encouraging, the opposite is also true in countries where some of the world's longest-serving leaders continue to hold power. VOA correspondent Maria Madiallo reports on the overall trends that are speaking both hope and worry.
Ethiopia saw unprecedented political change in 2018, says Ruben Brigidy, former U.S. ambassador to the African Union.
The historic decision of former Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn to voluntarily relinquish power is something that's never happened in Ethiopian history before. It paved the way for the entree of the current Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy Ahmed, who has made a series of incredible political reforms, the release of political prisoners, to leading the effort to appoint the first female president in Ethiopia's history.
The second most populous country in Africa also made peace with its neighbor, Eritrea, after 20 years of hostility. But nearly 1 million people have been displaced in southern Ethiopia since clashes erupted there in April, according to UN agencies. In Zimbabwe, the forced resignation of President Robert Mugabe in late 2017 paved the way for elections this year. Ken Opalo, assistant professor of African politics at Georgetown University.
It wasn't democratic, but it was a transition. And I think any transition is better than no transition, especially if it's done constitutionally, which, ZANU-PF jumped through a lot of hoops to make it look like it was a democratic transition.
The elections were won by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, a longtime ally of Mugabe, making some wonder if this was a real transition from the old guard.
I think, you know, as we're seeing in Mozambique and Angola, any transition is good because the new set of rulers typically want to, you know, be their own men and women. And so they'll implement reforms like you're seeing in Angola that may not always go well with the previous regime.
As the year draws to an end, attention turns to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which will hold elections on December 23rd. Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution in Washington.
If those go passably well, I think this is a huge boost forward, because that will be combined, as I see it, with, you know, not so bad trends in Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania.
While trends for democracy are encouraging, countries like Congo-Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea, Cameroon, Sudan, and Uganda are home to some of the longest-serving presidents in Africa. In the case of Equatorial Guinea's president, Theodoro Obiangema Mbasogo, 2019 will mark his 40th year in power. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.